Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we're going all the way back to the beginning to how cultural depictions of pregnancy and birth and maybe babies work and don't work. And then we'll try for a little inspiration in the form of culture that's inspired us. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You might be hearing this podcast on your smartphone or your computer, things most of us view as absolutely essential. For many people, being connected to a screen all day is the new norm. So what is all this screen time doing to us? NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking those questions in a special two-part episode all about our relationships with our screens, how they're changing the way we interact with others, and how they'll shape our future. Listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. Find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We've got inspiration. We've got babies. It's a near festival of warmth. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week, one of our very favorite human beings freshly returned to us from a stint on the West Coast, Barry Hardiman. What do you do at NPR? What do you do?
I am an editor at NPR's Weekend Edition.
As I already mentioned, we're going to go in the direction of talking a little bit about pregnancy and childbirth. And if you're sitting there thinking, I wonder if this is their Labor Day show.
Yeah, see what they did?
I'm here to tell you. It's our Labor Day show. We're taping the day after Labor
Day.
That's
okay. First babies are often late.
But this is exactly what happened. We were sitting around thinking, can we do anything around Labor Day? And someone said, oh, we could do labor like babies. And then we realized we'd never done pregnancy and childbirth and babies as a cultural thing on the show. So we wanted to talk about all of that stuff. And that's part of why we're so happy that Barry, who has acquired two children.
Totally acquired them.
In the time that we've been doing the show.
That is true.
Is here with us. So, Barry, the first thing I wanted to ask you is, in your experience, how does television and how do movies and how do books?
I'm so glad you didn't ask me how babies are made.
How does fiction,
yes,
in your experience, represent the experience of being pregnant and having babies?
Well, fiction does quite a good job. In fact, don't worry, everybody, but I could actually do like a small batch on Anna Karenina and Dolly's experience of motherhood and childbirth. I'm not kidding. There's literally a moment where she talks about cracked nipples. It's amazing.
We will get letters asking for this, which means we're going to have to eventually do it.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. I'm literally carrying it in my bag
because
it falls open to the... Anyway, I'm just saying. I have always found it to be quite rewarding in that I do think Anna Karenina has a really interesting moment in it. You know, The Handmaid's Tale. I think Beloved, Toni Morrison, is just an incredible experience through that. And in general, you know, in the last couple of years, I think that, you know, in fact, I think this year is the year that After Birth came out, which is Melissa Alpert's novel about a traumatic C-section. Now, as many listeners may know, I had two very untraumatic C-sections. I loved them. I'd go back anytime my mother is visiting. And I'm just kidding.
Barry has a lovely essay that she wrote for NPR after her first C-section.
But that said, I respect that everybody wants to have their babies the way they want to have them.
Of course.
And so, speaking of books, I will say I do think, for my money, I think The Handmaid's Tale is probably my favorite because I think in general, science fiction and fantasy do very, very well describing an experience which is out of body, which is extremely odd, which does feel like you have an alien inside you and then outside of you. I mean, there's really nothing, you know, you have this thing inside you and then you're like pushing your liver around in a stroller. It's a very odd experience. It does feel alien. Margaret Atwood famously didn't depict anything that wouldn't have happened in some society. And so there is the separation of the handmaids and the wives, and it's your classic feminist childbirth tale.
Sure.
So for my money, that's the thing. But what I do think that there has been books about women and the female experience and childbirth being central in some ways to that experience have begun to really pop up. And the treatment of childbirth as an experience that is as central as the experience as war may be to men,
Oh, interesting.
Is a thing that is really happening. So I don't know if you guys read Arielle Levy's just monumental piece in The New Yorker maybe 2 years ago about losing her baby in Mongolia.
Yeah. I don't think I did.
It was an epic birth story. And the sort of the area of the birth story online is, you know, is really flourishing.
No, totally,
and so now this is, you know, there was a wonderful long read on an emergency C-section. I know that doesn't sound, I can't believe I just said that sentence. But I mean, this has become a thing, like the birth story, the proliferation has, and now it has made it into, in more interesting ways beyond the sort of the ER and that kind of thing. I think it's really made itself, now it is central to pop culture.
Yeah. Stephen, you are the other one of us who has children, although your relationship to birth is not quite the same as Barry's, as you
it
were
was
never
a little,
pregnant.
A little easier, my role.
Right, exactly. When you look at stories about pregnancy and childbirth, how do you react to them based on your experience?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Barry is a book person, and I'm more of a TV, movies, music person. And so when I was writing down examples of how pregnancy and labor and birth are depicted in culture, it was all frustrations. It was all cliches that drive me crazy.
Yeah, men being like, what do I do now?
Exactly. Well, I mean, I could go on about like bumbling dumb old dad, which, you know, is a recurring frustration from conception to adulthood, you know, process. The way dads are depicted drives me nuts. But the way pregnancy and childbirth are depicted tend to be very frustrating as well. You mentioned all these great examples in fiction. One example that fiction has is that it's long. You use the phrase long read several times. Yeah. Like, there are exceptions, of course, where women give birth in taxis and stuff. They give birth in taxis about 500 million times as often on TV shows as they do in life.
Thanks, Matt, about you.
What usually happens is a woman goes into labor, they go to the hospital, and it is like 24 brutally exhausting hours
trying to get food.
In which the woman never yells, "You did this to me."
Right. And, I had that written down right here.
Never breaks her partner's hand, you know, by squeezing too hard.
Yeah.
I mean, all the haplessness. I mean, under ideal circumstances, the partner in a childbirth situation is trying their best to be like a doula. You know, is trying to be as supportive as possible. And mostly what for that person and for, I mean, I can't speak obviously for the, from the perspective of the person giving birth. It's a grind. It's not as loud as it is on TV. It's not as dramatic as it is on TV for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so it's frustrating because it never feels right. And of course, then at the end of it, the woman is handed a 3-month-old mucus-free infant.
And I will say one that I remember that really kind of got into that lengthy process was when Rachel had her baby on Friends.
Oh, that's right.
That kind of went on and on and on. And they got more and more aggravated because people were kind of coming and going and having their babies.
Baby
then she started to get very irritated when it was like, but they came in after us. It's like you're being waited on in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think there were many other things about that, those episodes that would play into a lot of the cliches you're talking about.
There are faults in those episodes as well.
Of course.
Sure.
But
the
as
blowout.
To that, as to the, yeah, but as to that one episode, that one aspect, it did try to get at that just, it's just endless. It's taking forever. She's so tired.
I mean, they could do a season of that show, like 24.
Where
like it's the entire process.
Sure.
Yeah, the sitcom TV tropes has already kind of provided us with a hierarchy, a taxonomy of all this stuff.
Right.
They have the delivery guy, the hapless delivery guy. They have you did this to me. And the reason that middle-aged people who have had no personal experience with childbirth know the word Lamaze is because of sitcoms. It's because of sitcoms like MASH and Benson and Welcome Back, Kotter and Frasier and Night Court. They all did this. They all did the emergency birth in a cab or in an elevator. It's actually called on TV tropes, you know, birth in an elevator. They all did the instant birth where it's the water breaks.
Oh, yeah. And then there's a baby just flops
screaming
out.
And you're handed a Gerber baby. It's all solidified. So I'm happy to hear from Barry that things are moving on and we're getting more personal.
Well, I actually, what I think is so great, and this is, I've been watching Outlander, which I think is kind of revolutionary in terms of the way it deals with sex and gender.
And bodies and stuff like that.
And I know episode 9 and I can have that conversation with anyone who wants to. But the birth episode, which I think is really great and is funny and wonderful and has all of the things that Outlander, that make, I think, Outlander special. But one thing that's really great about it, every scene gets something right. Like, okay, that one is really long. This one gets a couple of things right, which is unusual. So you have really a swollen body.
Right.
You have a woman who is not laboring on her back. You have, now you also do have an impossibly beautiful person turning a breech baby.
Sure.
So, which, you know, may happen.
Yeah.
But as the mother of two breech babies, I am glad it didn't happen in 18th century Scotland. However, so that is the thing. And then, of course, I mean, I don't think we can go a step further without saying the words called the midwife, which has been incredibly popular and is so wonderful and really, I think, it works very hard to make it look right. And those are newborns. I mean, there's a whole, you can Google, there's this great thing about how they get the newborn babies and whatever. So, you know, I do think that
they get,
God, there is a rebirth of, I'm sorry, there are going to be so many of those guys, of as the birth story has become more, you know, I think we're seeing more than on TV. Now, here's the thing that I think we ought to talk about is whether or not my initial feeling about that is that's great for women, right? This is, you know, this is now we're seeing more birth stories that are true to life. I remember in Knocked Up, which I think shows a fairly, I mean, in a funny way, a fairly accurate portrayal of a, you know, an officious doctor insisting on interventions. And they also quite famously show crowning. As these things have happened, I think we're getting more of the full experience of women. However, the flip side of this is that as we've gotten away from, you know, childbirth as plot point, because usually it's the catalyst, like, it's a paternity problem, or now they've got to get out of the castle, or hell, Atlanta's burning, or whatever, you know, is that now, it used to be that the wedding was the most important thing in the female character's life, and now all we can do is have babies.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a real pickle. It's a pickle, my friends.
Do you feel, I mean, you said that this many depictions are good for women. Did you find when you were pregnant that you had in your head a bunch of misleading garbage about, like, what the labor process would be like?
Well, I did. And partly that's because of shows like TLC is a Baby Story, which I also watched, and which I think is really kind of fascinating about the whole experience, is that even those things, which are true, those are real babies getting born out of real vaginas. Like, it's happening. And yet everybody's still performing their role. So you can actually see the woman's like, there's a camera on me.
Yeah.
I better get mad at my husband.
Yeah.
You know? And so even the guys are like, it's time for me to be a bumbling fool.
Right.
Yep.
And so even the, you know, it is sort of fascinating because no matter what, you are still performing this drama in the human race.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where, and I say this as someone who does not have kids, has never been pregnant. I think when I observe from the outside cultural conversations around birth, I always think there's a parallel between how we talk about birth and how we talk about death and grieving, which is everybody is so invested in making sure that everyone thinks that the way they did it was the right way, that it becomes an unbelievably emotional thing, despite the fact that those are perhaps the two times when everyone else ought to leave you the most space to decide what you think is right for you. And so these cultural portrayals become incredibly fraught if you try to take them seriously. And one of the things that I always notice, particularly you mentioned Call the Midwife, but about any kind of period representation of childbirth, whether it's in Call the Midwife or like Downton Abbey or something like that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I think the best ones are the ones that acknowledge, and this is even still true, but was even more true, that was a very dangerous moment in the life of women and couples and families to make sure that everything went okay.
Yeah.
And it was a dangerous thing.
There were two lives that could be lost.
And so you wind up with these, I always appreciate in any representation that it doesn't just become about the woman being like, huh, huh, huh. And like Stephen said, yelling at the man, you did this to me.
Yeah.
And then boom, and then she has the baby.
Right.
As you said, when you were talking about an actual like swollen person, like that you are dealing with a physical trauma, right?
And
that needs to be part of the portrayal, or I always find it unbelievably hollow because it doesn't really honor what that physical experience is.
Exactly.
You know?
Can we go back to talking about what's really important here is how it affects the dad? This is something that I don't think it's talked about nearly enough. I mean,
It actually doesn't.
It's beautiful and, you know, there's a new life, shooting out your Georgia O'Keeffe. That's great.
Right, exactly.
But the important thing is how is it affecting the dad?
You know, sometimes people confuse our voices. This is Glenn talking.
There is a 1956 Merry Melodies short called Rocket by Baby it was directed by Chuck Jones with voices by Dawes Butler and June Foray, one of the few that didn't have Mel Blanc in it. And it opens like this.
This is the planet Mars. In the summer of 1954, this planet passed extremely close to the Earth, so close that a cosmic force was disturbed. And a baby intended for the Earth was delivered to Mars, while a Martian baby went by mistake to the Earth.
So it opens in this waiting room, which when you look up 1956 in Encyclopedia, it is this image of just white dudes in a maternity waiting room with 5 o'clock shadows, and they're chain smoking, and their ties are slightly undone.
Oh, God.
And a man is called in to see his baby. It's green with antennae because it's a Martian baby. And kind of goes zzz, 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 zzz. And remarkably, this whole cartoon is about the relationship between the dad and the son. The mom's there, but she's basically to Hector him to say, you have to take the kid outside to get fresh air. And he's like, but what if somebody sees him? And then there's a famous scene where he runs into an old lady. Old lady says, what a beautiful green baby, green. And then she takes out a pitch pipe, blows it, and then screams because that's, you know, that's the gag. And it concludes by him falling to his death, but there's a twist ending. 60-year-old spoiler alert, it was all a dream. But let's break into response groups and just unpack that. What is the anxiety that this is touching on? It's that the suburban white male of 1956 is in total control, except in this one tiny area of his life where
he is stuck
in the waiting room, surrendering his power to the system.
Right.
What does the system do when you lose control? It disappoints you.
Yep.
A screw-up happens, and it burdens him with otherness, with the thing you don't want in 1956, with nonconformity. And yeah, it's about, oh, the baby's got antennae, and the baby's doing the Einstein equation in blocks. They keep going back to the color of this kid's skin, that he's green, over and over again. So it is
eternity.
A fascinating snapshot of that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's very interesting.
And actually reminds me of Mad Men.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that same thing, that Don Draper very much had that experience when Betty had baby Jean.
Of course, so did Betty.
But. Right. No, but I'm saying, he had the dad experience, is what I'm saying. He had that like pacing in the waiting room experience, and people talked about how different it was, and that she went into that whatever they called it, twilight sleep or whatever,
which looked awesome to me, and everybody was like, "That seemed so terrible," and I was like, "Where?" I was pregnant. I was like, "Where can I get me some twilight sleep? It seems amazing. In fact, I'll take some right now."
But here's what I find interesting about these portrayals is like you're saying, like it's so personal.
But you mentioned fiction, and earlier in this discussion, you mentioned science fiction. Yeah. I mean, there are much discussed tropes in science fiction about the mystical pregnancy like Scully on the X-Files, like infested with an alien baby.
Rosemary's Baby. There's no more terrifying birth story on film.
Yeah,
no,
that's true.
And the treatment of pregnancy as torture porn.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Which, you know, when you know,
as
we were
body horror.
And we were talking about
very
like,
much like in Prometheus in particular. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, and we're talking about the fact that the accumulation of these portrayals of pregnancy and childbirth as this like otherworldly trauma. Of course it is traumatic. It is an incredibly difficult process.
Yeah.
But like it always gets exaggerated in order to ratchet up drama. And in science fiction, it is like a particularly serialized science fiction. You know, it happens as like a one episode plot device.
Right. It's the metaphor for the anxiety that you experience while you're pregnant. It's just made literal.
Right.
Given tentacles.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, I think there are times when shows, TV shows in particular, like more and less showing people being pregnant. So if they like the pregnancy story, the person will be pregnant for a very, very long time.
Yes.
And if they really just want to get to a baby story, a newborn. Then sometimes people get pregnant and they'll get pregnant in the spring at the end of the season. And then by the time the fall comes, they're almost ready to have the baby and, you know, or they'll skip a bunch of stuff in the middle.
I have to. That reminds me of shout out the quickest and worst pregnancy in fiction, which is Breaking Dawn, wherein the baby vampire is, first of all, she's like the mother wastes away. She has to drink gallons of blood. Now, here's where the father really comes in handy because he has to chew that little darling thing out of the womb, and then afterwards, my God! I mean, how romantic! Like her mother's old lover imprints on this thing, and as his future mate. I mean, there's almost no more, and that's like we got to get to this baby. Like that was the. I mean, remember in the movie, it's like does not feel quick in the movie.
No, but he does. They do the little like his bloody post chewing.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
It's super gross, But I do think that that's, I mean, I do think that when Stephen talks about kind of science fiction portrayals, like, this is how fraught it is, right?
Yeah. Oh,
that you
sure.
wind up either with this tradition of like the hoo, 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 and then the baby comes out on the one hand, or on the other hand, these extraordinary kind of monster movie portrayals. Yeah. And it can be very, very hard to find like that in between point. I think when we talk about like the things about pregnancy, and I, and again, this is based entirely on my experiences with tons and tons of people that I've known and loved and talked to, the thing that's still like the birth, that birth experience like you're talking about is now not particularly taboo. What I think is still very hard to talk about and really does not ever get played in fiction is the ambivalence and anxiety that people sometimes have while they're waiting for babies to be born, which is, I'm not going to say universal among people I know who have had babies, but at some level, it is near universal.
I sure sat across from you in a sushi restaurant and had those feelings. So, and
I,
that
like nervousness about like, will I know what to do? Am I going to have the feelings that I want to have? Am I going to have the feelings that are the right feelings when people judge me?
Yeah.
And it's I think that part remains like super, super difficult to talk about.
And it's still, and the thing is, because it, like death, like you say, it is totally mystical. There is no, I mean, we can still, we can put a name to love. We can say, oh, I know what that is. I know what sex is. I know what attraction, I know what those things are. I know what my sibling even, but that thing, you know, the thing that you, and that everybody has because you feel it for your mom, you know, whether you've had the kid or not, or, or you don't feel it for your mom or whatever. Everybody has that relationship. It's totally mystical. It's like the one thing we really can't explain. Oh, I got real mushy.
No, I like it. I like it. And I think it is entirely appropriate to give Barry, our mother of two, since the show started, the last word.
Wait, can I say one last
word? Of course you can.
Shout out to the seven people that care about this. My favorite science fiction silly moment is Midwife Worf, where he delivers Keiko and Miles's baby. I just want to, of the tropes of the like the weird midwife, like, oh no, I've got to deliver your baby. The Worf as midwife, guys, look it up.
Oh yeah.
Look it up.
Very, very good. All right. Well, I will be, I think that I can safely say that many of you out there will send us examples of stuff that you like and don't like about how fiction and TV and movies and stuff handles childbirth and pregnancy, and we're excited to hear
and
that.
And send me a birth story. I love reading birth stories. I read them all day long.
So find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH and tell us what you think. When we get back, it's going to be time for some inspiration. So don't go away.
Support for this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from Casper. They're an online retailer for mattresses. Casper mattresses are American-made and obsessively engineered for comfort. They use two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, to give just the right amount of sink and bounce. And they have a risk-free trial. You can try out your Casper mattress for 100 days with free delivery and returns. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. So go to casper.com/happyhour to check out their options. And they have a special offer for listeners of this podcast. Use the promo code HAPPYHOUR to redeem $50 towards a Casper mattress that works for you.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we talked about labor and delivery, and now we're going to talk about inspiration. Not necessarily to engage in labor and delivery, but inspiration in general. This is, I believe, a user-submitted topic. Glenn Weldon, can you tell me about a moment in pop culture that inspired you?
Well, coming up with this, I didn't want to repeat myself, because one of the things about moments that inspired you is that if you have a show where you talk about pop culture for 5 years, and they are that seminal to you, you're going to mention them before. So like the Adam West Batman television show that started in 1966, I mean, I have talked about it before, how hugely important it was to me. Maybe I've talked about how hugely important it is to the character of Batman and how everything we know about Batman today was formed in violent reaction to that show.
Right, yes.
A person could write a book about how important
a person could write a book. If you asked a person could write a book.
I've talked about how when I was a kid, Merry Melodies made me, which I memorized, made me internalize all these references to 1940s politics. Like, I was a 7-year-old kid going around the playground saying, "It ain't Wendell Willkie," because so many of my conversations revolved around the 1940 Republican nomination. Comics I've talked about. Steve Martin, I think I've talked about before, his comedy album. I could go into my brother's room. He was 6 years older than me on hot summer nights because he had air conditioning. I didn't. And we'd listen to them. I was assured, relatively assured, that for those 45 minutes, I would not be punched. So that was good. But ultimately, I'm going to stick with Abbott and Costello. Abbott and Costello films were shown on Channel 48 in Philadelphia on Sunday mornings right after church. Now, the world breaks down into your Three Stooges people, your Abbott and Costello people, your Marx Brothers people.
Yes.
And I maintain that the cultural cachet they have assumed has something to do with their availability, their market value,
sure.
how common they are.
Yeah.
The Stooges were on every afternoon. They were common. You saw them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, Abbott and Costello was once a week. And Marx Brothers were only seen during PBS pledge breaks. Which put the stink of something suspicious about them for me. they reeked of Mark Russell, as far as I was concerned.
Uh-huh,
I didn't trust them. The Stooges, the formula for the Stooges is slapstick plus mugging plus sound effects. And if you doubt that, try to watch any Three Stooges short without the sound effects. That eye gouge without that violin string plunk does not work and looks pretty creepy. I was a Stooge hipster. I preferred Shemp.
Of course you did.
Because, again, if everybody likes Curly, I would even argue for Joe because he was a sissy, and it kind of resonated with me. I'm not going to go for Curly Joe because I'm not a monster. The Marx Brothers, again, you had people like Dick Cavett and William F. Buckley telling you how risibly anarchic they were,
mm-hmm.
which, nope. And I'm going to tell you something about the Marx Brothers. Groucho is doing all the heavy lifting there.
Mm-hmm.
He is the B in that BLT. You can dispense with the other two, and you still have Groucho. Chico, he's doing the one thing. I'm aware of his work, and it's, you know, it's inoffensive, unless you're the Italian-American Anti-Defamation League, in which case it's probably offensive.
Yeah.
Harpo.
Mm.
Harpo.
Wow, the sneer.
Harpo is an insidious attempt to sneak mime into comedy. And I see what you're doing. It's like when your mom makes you mashed potatoes, and she's like, how'd you like the mashed potatoes? And you're like, they're fine. And she says, they're cauliflower. What have you done to me? Abbott and Costello, they came from burlesque. Their bits were, well, they're slapstick, and of course, Lou Costello was mugging to beat the band.
Yes.
But they were, their bits were language. Their bits were wordplay. Their bits were, like the Marx Brothers in a sense, but, and
right.
those films were strung together very loosely along a, like Christmas lights. You had bit, 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 number by the Andrews Sisters, bit, bit, bit.
Right.
With no necessarily plot, very workmanlike plots, until you get to the first time I saw a film of theirs, the 18th film they made together called The Time of Their Lives. It was made in 1946. And this is a film that has a story. It's about ghosts. It's about Marjorie Reynolds and Lou Costello play these two Revolutionary War era characters who are killed and thrown down a well, and they have to haunt this estate until they can clear their name from being traitors. And it's one of the films, one of the few films where Abbott and Costello don't play partners. They just play different people in the cast because Abbott is playing a real heel,
mm-hmm.
and Costello is playing the guy you love. I haven't seen this film in many, many years, but this was everything I loved about Abbott and Costello, plus story, plus mm-hmm. stakes. It was so much richer, more involving. It has this thing about, are they going to get out of it? So yeah, that's the thing that really, really inspired me as a kid, just to seek out richer stories, because it wasn't just blank comedy. It made me realize what, if you are invested in the characters, if you care about them, if they're not just there to gouge each other in the eye, it matters more.
Yeah, and I will say, not to be the person who only knows the one thing, but I was talking to somebody recently about the fact that I heard Who's on First on the radio recently on WAMU on the big broadcast, which is the thing they have with vintage radio shows. And I listened to it and I thought, this is like The Princess Bride, in that if you've heard people quote it back to you for 20 years, or I mean, much longer, obviously, but in your own life for 20 years, you got to go listen to the actual thing, because it's way better than the million imitators of it. Partly for exactly the reason that you're saying, which is like, it has a story. Like there is a roundness to that interaction that isn't just that joke. It's not just the joke about the mix-ups of names. There's a story about frustration, and there's a story about miscommunication and frustration that's really kind of, it's a little rounder than it seems. I love that pick.
And it's a burlesque piece. It's meant to be performed live, but because Lou Costello is Lou Costello, he puts so much of that frustration in his voice, and the strangled quality of his voice, that it worked great for radio.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I absolutely love that. Great pick. How about you, Thompson?
Well, I brought a bunch of examples of like baby's first brush with obsession. And for like early pop culture obsessions and how they shaped probably my own view of myself as a pop culture consumer. One of my first obsessions was with old Jack Benny radio shows. Mm-hmm. Speaking of old radio, my parents supplied me, my parents and my uncle supplied me with endless like boxes of old cassette tapes with Jack Benny shows taped on them, and I would listen to them and literally wear them out. But like none of my friends listened to Jack Benny radio shows.
Right,
I mean, at one point in sixth grade, it was some kind of show and tell, and I brought got in a funny clip from, I think it was the Elephant's Graveyard episode of the Jack Benny Show. I mean, all these references, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it brought the house down. I wasn't just the weird kid who brought in old radio shows. I mean, I was. That was a great first brush with, like, loving something mm-hmm. esoteric and kind of having it to yourself mm-hmm. among yes. your group of friends. I was similarly obsessed when I was, like, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old with Dave Barry's writing mm-hmm. and was, like, was gobbling up Dave mm-hmm. Barry books and Dave Barry columns. And, like, later when I worked at The Onion, everyone looked down their noses at Dave Barry, who wasn't cool enough. Mm-hmm. And I had to, like, that was my, like, my secret shame was that I loved and frankly still love
sure.
Dave Barry. Very funny. Duck Amuck. Mm-hmm. I watched Duck Amuck, that cartoon, approximately 780,000 times and was like an early discovery in meta.
Yeah,
you know,
meta humor,
like the fourth wall yeah. coming down, which has always been just a favorite device of mine. On my 17th birthday, my mom drove me to the movie theater, and I sat and watched UHF, the Weird Al Yankovic movie, uh-huh. And I was the only one in the theater.
Yeah,
and so, like, early examples, like, I guess it's like obsession and isolation, mm-hmm. which right. are such themes of being a teenager.
And so. And like Glenn said, those are some greatest hits from you mm-hmm. that we have sometimes talked about
couple,
on the show.
Some of those we've talked about,
and I think it demonstrates that, like, things that inspire you are the things that you go back to,
that come,
and
you
that
come back
become
to again and
formative,
again.
And so you come back to them again and again.
I mean, it's inevitable that certain things are going to come up again and again. I did bring an example I know I've never talked about,
okay.
which was one of the original drafts of this idea was, like, miniature pop culture moments, some incredibly tiny, mm-hmm. granular moment. And so one of my other picks is the end of an episode of the Tony Randall sitcom Love, Sydney.
Okay.
Which ran...
Where is this going?
Which ran from 1981 to 1983 is notable primarily for being...
That long, huh?
Yeah. Notable primarily for being the first gay lead protagonist in a U.S. TV show,
okay.
network TV show. Of course, his homosexuality was acknowledged virtually never.
Yeah.
But at the end of the episode, they would have the announcer would intone what was happening on the next episode. And I believe I have isolated the exact episode this was based on the title, that this aired on October 9th, 1982. And the announcer says, "A life-threatening accident puts Patty in a coma." And I might be misquoting. That's only seared into my memory. Patty was the little girl
right?
who
uh-huh.
was being raised in yeah. Sydney Shore's apartment. And I remember just spending the entire week like, oh my God, like, this show has taken such a dark turn.
This is a dark
place. I was 10. And,
Patty's going to be in a coma.
She's going to be in a coma. Like, this is going to be, like, long-term care is going mm-hmm. to be part of, like, where they go with this show. And the next episode, like, Patty, like, falls off a swing or whatever and is briefly hospitalized. And then it's just like, Patty's fine. And it was one of my first experiences with feeling lied to.
Oh, I see.
So yeah. Love, Sydney, 1982.
Barry Hardyman, to inspire you.
So you may know I loved musicals as a child. Uh-huh. I was really raised on the bread and butter of the Oklahoma and kind of, you know,
right.
and in those
sure.
musicals, there's a lot of, you know, it's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, and everybody in tonic dominant, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And I remember my mom would play cassettes of these different musicals in the car. And the one that we played all the time was Pal Joey. And I didn't understand Pal Joey when I was little, because it's so complex. And then we saw it on stage when I was, I don't know, maybe 10, I think at the Huntington Theater Company. And it was the first time I saw a real person portrayed with real flaws portrayed in what was ostensibly like a real jazz hands
mm-hmm.
musical.
Mm-hmm.
Many of you may have seen the movie, which is Frank Sinatra. It's so good. But it also has the little problem of the ending is different. So when I saw it for the first time on stage...
Pal Joey spoiler.
Yeah, exactly. Which is that he doesn't get... He makes the wrong decision at the end. But what's so wonderful about...
Damn it, I had that in my DVR.
Yeah. Well, if you watch the movie, which is pretty much the only way you're going to see it, mm-hmm. you'll see everybody, you know, Kim Novak runs off them.
Mm-hmm.
What was really inspiring to me, and I think actually really had a great impact on the way that I read fiction now, is this idea. He was the first anti-hero I really fell in love with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Joey is not, he's this, you know, disreputable, terrible nightclub owner. He is ambitious, but he's got big dreams. And he's not mean. He's
mm-hmm.
just weak.
Mm. Yeah.
And that distinction, that was the first time I really understood that distinction, that you could be not a jerk, not a bad fella, or lady or dame in Pal Joey. Mm-hmm. But you could be just weak. You could just do the wrong thing, and maybe it wasn't even for the right reason or the wrong reason. So I'm going to go with Pal Joey.
Helping you understand, not mean, just weak.
Right.
A distinction I wish I had understood before I started dating.
Oh, my God. Well, I know. It's not like I understood it well enough in my 20s, but that's
all right.
Okay.
This, what this did with me, I started thinking about, like, what exactly I even wanted to take being inspired to mean. Mm-hmm. Like, are we talking about literally inspired, like the time young Linda confessed her feelsies to some dude because, God only knows, by Beach Boys came on the car radio, and it seemed like that was what I was supposed to do.
Man.
It was not what I was supposed to do.
No.
But
God, you didn't know.
This is the most tragic. This is now the most tragic episode of this podcast
in
history.
This is taking a dark turn.
No, but I mean, it was like nothing. It wasn't terrible. But literally, that was my like, all right, darn it. And then, of course, I wished I hadn't, because you know what? That's not a good reason. It's a compelling reason, but it's not a good reason. So that's one thing that you can mean when you say it inspires me, right? And that's related to people who say, like, this inspires me when I go running or whatever.
Sure.
It actually literally drives something that you're doing other than listening to or experiencing the thing. I saw this movie and it made me want to be a dancer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think the best kind of inspiration for me is the kind where you see somebody doing really good work, like work that you would like to do. Mm. And it makes you think, I think this maybe only applies if you are in some kind of creative profession. I don't know if there's a direct analog for other people. But for me, like, I was very inspired, like, and this is not, again, not going to surprise anybody, but when I first started reading, like, the recaps on what was then Dawson's Rap, which then became Mighty Big TV, which became Television Without Pity, like, that was something that I read, and I thought, oh, and the internet, which was much younger, and this way of processing television and pop culture was much younger, as far as experiencing it with a lot of arched eyebrow, and I thought it was so funny and so fun, and I remember one of my friends saying, and now, why don't you write for these people? And I remember saying, because I could never do that. But I think clearly over time, it drove kind of my interest in the kind of writing that I wanted to do at that time. There's that kind of direct inspiration. And then there's the bad kind of inspiration, which is the kind where something that you read, in my case, that tends to be reading, is so good that it makes you think, like, okay, I quit. Never mind. And I actually, it was funny because I was remembering the other day when I interviewed Judy Blume at Sixth and I Synagogue in Washington over the summer. She told me that she never reads fiction while she's writing fiction. And my first takeaway was, oh, you know, like, you're afraid it's going to get in your head and influence what you're writing. So do you just, like, stay away from it? She said, no. She said, there are too many things that I know that if I pick them up and I read them, that I'll say, oh, well, this is writing. I am a ridiculous hack, and I'll put them down. She told some story about picking up a book, and, like, it stopped her from writing for weeks. She just couldn't write for weeks because she was so intimidated by it. So I think that is another form of inspiration where you see something and you're like, it motivates you, but, like, in reverse.
Exactly.
It motivates you. What you want is the thing that pushes you just far enough where you're like, this is great, and I want to do, this is the kind of great thing I would love to do. Right. But you don't want it to tip over into intimidation.
I'm inspired to hang it up.
Right, exactly.
All right. Yeah. When we come back, we are going to talk about our favorite thing. And we're rolling along with our theme of happiness, which thus far Glenn has survived. Mm. We've only got one more segment left. And of course, it is what is making us happy this week. We will be right back.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You might be hearing this podcast on your smartphone or your computer, things most of us view as absolutely essential. For many people, being connected to a screen all day is the new norm. So what is all this screen time doing to us? NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking those questions in a special two-part episode all about our relationships with our screens, how they're changing the way we interact with others, and how they'll shape our future. Listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. Find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy, buddy?
Well, several months ago, I referred to the lackluster, shall we say, theatrical grosses of the film United Passions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The FIFA-funded mash note not, yes. to FIFA mm-hmm. itself, which made $918 in theaters.
On its opening weekend?
On its opening weekend. Yeah. No, total.
Oh, total.
I believe that's total. I mean, I saw a story online that said that was its total grosses and that it was the lowest grossing U.S. theatrical release of all time.
That's amazing.
Which is really remarkable. And it just gave me a little pang of joy when I saw that it's been released on DVD. It's on DVD.
Adorable.
Its Metacritic score is 1 mm-hmm. out of 100.
Like one.
1 yeah. out of 100.
Yeah. There's always one guy.
Who's like, I think it's 1 better than 0.
Yeah.
But it's like, I named my dog FIFA. I had it.
But it's hubris. It's this doubling down. But in this case, it's kind of just because you sort of have to.
Mm-hmm.
But like the fact that like a movie that made $918, you would have to manufacture DVDs. Mm-hmm. It's just a little story that has delighted me so much.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw just a little update mm-hmm. on United Passions. Last Friday, I received the honor and distinction of being named by the delightful Rachel Martin. Mm-hmm. As she was hosting All Things Considered, she named me NPR's AHA correspondent.
There we go.
In honor of our discussion of the Norwegian pop band AHA, which has a new album out called Cast in Steel, but which also has, and I just received it, a 30th anniversary copy of the album Hunting High and Low, which contains Take on Me, which we talked about at great and greatly enjoyable length. That 30th edition does not contain any bonus material, which it turns out is unnecessary because all you will do is listen to Take on Me over and over and over again.
That was a very, very fun piece, though.
It was so fun to get to do it, and it was really fun to read the comments on the web build.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, an announcement for our listeners in the great city of Los Angeles, a city our own Barry Hardiman has just vacated. Linda Holmes and I will be hosting our very first awards banquet.
It's true.
We will be hosting the Online Journalism Awards given out by the Online News Association.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, we will be handing trophies to real journalists.
That's right.
Who report on serious events occasionally.
People we greatly admire in many cases.
In many cases. Pretty... The list of nominees is kind of a wish list of people in our field that would be really fun to meet. It will be an opportunity for us to hold some sort of public meetup since we so rarely get out to the West Coast
mm-hmm.
in any kind of official capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So end of this month, Holmesy and I...
we're trying out our bit writing.
Yeah, right?
Which I have a feeling it's going to teach me how hard it is.
Yeah. I have a feeling it may change our perspective on awards shows.
Please hold your applause until the end.
A lot
it's
of people
not respectful.
Are
will there be a live feed?
I don't think so, no. But I think a lot of folks are going to think that we're getting what we deserve
mm-hmm.
if it doesn't go well. So thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week, sir?
Midnighter is a comic book character that historically has not really appealed to me. He was created by Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch in 1998 for a comic called Stormwatch that later transferred over into The Authority. He has a super healing power. He's got a super computer in his brain, which allows him to anticipate your movements, so he always wins every fight he's ever in. I get it, that superheroes are wish fulfillment, right? But this guy is specifically the wish fulfillment of the drunk geek that corners you at the party and is like, yeah, the Master Bruce Lee could reach into your chest and pull out your heart and show it to you before you die.
Right.
That guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a person with whom I historically do not truck. And the goof of this character, the joke of this character, is that he's gay Batman. He's in a relationship with a character called Apollo, who is the Superman analog. And, you know, you say gay Batman, it's like your two passions. Why aren't you on board? Because of that. Because it's a little too on the nose. And,
sure.
And he's part of this movement, this 90s movement of extreme violent comics and everything like this. Also, the fact that he was in a relationship meant that they were trying to normalize him to make... It's okay to have a gay character in comics, but you just got to pair him up. And then very soon after that, they adopted a baby. Mm. It's like, okay, you can have a gay character. You can't have a single gay character because that would upset the fan base. There is a new Midnighter series. It's on issue 4 right now. And the writer, Steve Orlando, with art by somebody named ACO, don't know, and Stephen Mooney, they have made him single, and he is sexually active. And it's not explicit, but it is sexual. He has a sex life, just like every straight superhero is allowed to have now.
Sure. Yep.
So this. And it's remarkably funny and smart and still violent. But, you know, the writer is bi, and I think anybody can write anything. And I think straight people can write gay people. But there's a layer of something that just feels unforced, that there's not a boxes that need to be checked, that this research is sort of internalized, shall we say.
Okay.
That just feels right and easy on the page, and it's a lot of fun. So that's Midnighter from DC Comics.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, so I have been binge-watching a little bit.
Yes.
What I have been watching is, maybe everybody has already come to this, but Playing House with Jessica St. Clair.
I've been watching that.
And Lennon Parham. And it is so delightful. It's just a delight. It isn't perfect, but it is so nice to see these two. It's about a female friendship. One high-powered executive comes home to help her friend have a baby. I, in fact, probably should have brought this up in the A section of this show. It's such a darling show, and it has the addition of Keegan-Michael Key.
Yes.
What I love about it is it's really a lovely portrayal of a female friendship, and it's about that. It's not pretending to be about the maybe will they or won't they with Key and St. Clair.
It's the primary relationship in both
is
of their
these
lives.
Ladies.
Yeah. And they're not super long seasons, so they're easy to, easy to get through.
They're so consumable. So get a nice bottle of red and put your feet up, people.
Yep. And I think Glenn has maybe recommended this show in the past. So that's a couple of recommendations from us.
It's a duo.
All right. Very excellent. Thank you, Barry Hardiman. First of all, I should mention, sort of related to the inspiration theme, while watching a bunch of Project Runway this weekend, I finally unpacked and set up my sewing machine and taught myself how it works. And now I can make little pouches that I can sew shut all by myself. And it's pretty hot. I'm just going to say, you could get easily 85 cents for them at a flea market.
And I will pay that 85 cents and raise you to 95.
Yes.
You can create individual fork cozies.
Yes, absolutely. I could make, if you needed a fork cozy right now, I could make you a fork cozy. So that's A. B is, as we tape this, it is Tuesday, and tonight is Stephen Colbert's first show. Mm. So it is not so much Stephen Colbert's first show as much as some really, really terrific writing that has been done in my field of entertainment journalism around Stephen Colbert. First, a couple weeks ago, a piece that a lot of people talked about and shared in GQ by Joel Lovell. What I said at the time on Twitter is that the really good thing is that he had this experience with Colbert that happened with just the right writer, where if I had to psychoanalyze, I think Colbert was tired and a little bit worn out, and got into a conversation where he suddenly found himself kind of breaking out in tremendous earnestness, which he can do anyway. That's a little bit who that guy is. Mm-hmm. But I think even more than usual, there was a kind of an unguarded earnestness that came out that the writer was able to both encourage and feed and then write about in a way that was very open and very thoughtful, but didn't feel exploitive to me. It was the rare situation where the writer can put himself in the story a little bit, and yet it doesn't feel like they have made it about themselves. They're making it about an interaction that they had with this person, which is a very fine line, but I think that's a terrific piece. And then there was also a profile in the New York Times by Dave Itzkoff, who's just a fantastic writer of this kind of thing, and did a profile of Colbert as he's getting into all of this. And Dave's piece is so... it's respectful and it's admiring of what the guy has accomplished, but it doesn't feel sycophantic or anything like that. And people do get into a certain reverence with some of these guys in comedy, especially when they find one that feels like you can feel good about yourself liking. Mm-hmm. You'll get a kind of a flood of stuff that's uncritically not terribly thoughtful. And I think both of these pieces in very different ways really get at that guy in a way that I think is really cool and that I appreciated a lot. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Barry at B. Hardiman. That's B-H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll see you right back here next week.